And welcome everybody to Podcasting Them Softly, episode number 6. This is Nick. I'm here with Frank. Hey, Frank.
Hello.
And before we get into all of this week's topics, of which there are a few, we just definitely wanted to say thank you very much to Mark Pellington for sharing our podcasts and our written pieces on his movie, I Melt With You, which generated in a lot of interest in the site and in our work and also in the film itself, which deserves obviously a higher profile than it got initially. So we're both very excited and completely indebted to Mark for doing that, because it was a big push for us, and it really showed that, you know, we're reaching people with this, and you know, it means something to people who put themselves out there. So thank you very much if you are listening, Mark. If not, I'm sure we'll make a mention of it, you know, in a written fashion. But thanks again. And I would say that this would represent a big episode, because one of the most insane action films of all time has opened this weekend, which is George Miller's Fury Road. So we're going to be talking about that. We're also going to be discussing Jean-Pierre Jeunet's 2004 film, A Very Long Engagement, which was my selection for Film of the Week, and also highlighting top five performances from one of my favorite actors, Colin Farrell, and also Jodie Foster, who I've long been a fan of as well. And if we have some time, we'll get into some DVDs and Blu-rays that we saw during the week, but lots to get to with the meat of the situation. Frank, I want to kick it off to you and have you start the Fury Road discussion, seeing how you saw it on what you saw Thursday night, one of the early bird shows.
Yeah, I saw it Thursday at 7, the first showing. They're not even doing midnight shows anymore. It's just 7 the day before, which is cool, because I'm not really a fan of going to movies at midnight so much anymore as I've gotten older, depending on the film. But yeah, anyway. So Mad Max Fury Road. Dude, I was excited for the movie. All the reviews that came out this week were just, I didn't read any of them. I was just checking the Rotten Tomatoes count, which is ironic since last week we spoke about how Rotten Tomatoes is a poor barometer because it shits on films like I Melt With You and kills it. But anyway, Mad Max got 2 negative reviews out of what?
100.
Over 100.
100. And last time I checked, it was 187-2.
Yeah. I don't know what's going on with those two people, but Mad Max is everything you want it to be, everything you expect it to be, and then Miller takes it to another level, and he just doesn't take it to that level. He just leaps to that level. The film's insane, and it's audacious, outrageous. It's a spectacle. I absolutely loved it. Aesthetically, it's amazing. The colors of it are beautiful. He paints his own portrait of a post-apocalyptic world that we've never seen before. I mean, granted, we've seen it in Road Warrior, which I think of the original Mad Max trilogy, this film is most comparable to. And he makes his own unique brand with the subgenre or genre of post-apocalyptic worlds. It's truly a cross between The Road, the Cormac McCarthy book that was turned into a movie that I enjoyed.
Mm-hmm.
It's a cross between The Road and Brazil, I felt. It's just outrageous. And what I took away from it and what I thought made this film so epic, if you strip everything away from it, all the beautiful camera work, the practical effects, the CGI that looks real and not overused, the incredible performances by Hardy and particularly Charlize Theron, who I would not be surprised at all. Actually, I would be upset if she doesn't get nominated for an Oscar for it. She's that good in the movie.
We're going to get to the Oscar angle of this in a little bit, for sure. Go ahead, continue. Sorry to interrupt.
But this film is a feminist film. It's about feminism, which I absolutely loved. I can't think of too many films that try to tackle the topic of feminism that achieve it so well as Mad Max Fury Road. The only films that come to mind off the top of my head right now would be Scorsese's Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, and then Lars von Trier's Nymphomaniac, which came out last year, or the year before, last year. It was just, I was blown away by it. I mean, the movie's about bad controlling men and tough women with Mad Max kind of helping out. It's interesting how this film is formulated, because obviously Hardy's the title character is Mad Max, but it's not a Mad Max movie.
Mm-hmm.
He kind of takes a back seat to the theme and tone of saving these five beautiful women with Charlize Theron as an Ellen Ripley-esque badass woman, without a doubt. It was just very interesting how he constructed this, and I was expecting it to be the Tom Hardy show, which it is, but I thought it was just going to be Tom Hardy, 100%, killing people, saving the day, and it's not really that.
Yeah, without spoiling it, you're absolutely right. He's the reluctant helper, and the movie is not necessarily – it opens – through his point of view, certainly. But the movie is definitely really kicked into high gear with Charlize Theron and, her the protection that she's providing for these women. I don't want to spoil. See, it's one of the craziest things about this movie is just how overwhelming it is. And for me, I can't wait for another viewing already, because it just was mind-boggling to take to comprehend all of it. It just defies logic to me, most of this movie. I don't understand how somebody wasn't killed while making it. I was sort of, to be honest, and I don't know how you felt, I was distracted by the sheer physicality of some of this. And I started to sort of zero in on unimportant details because I was just so blown away by the technical aspects of this movie. It's just, yeah, computers were used, CGI was clearly used in the Sandstorm stuff and for digital replacement with bodies, but this movie, had this movie been done, if another filmmaker had the same exact script, the approach to the action would have been considerably different, I fear. George Miller schooled absolutely everybody right now that's currently making action films. The grandiosity of the thing, the stripped down nature of it, the lack of spoken exposition, the reliance on visual storytelling. I don't think this movie is a minute over 2 hours. And in this day and age of, ass numbing blockbusters that run 2.5 to 2:40 consistently, there was something refreshing and kind of novel about, when that last action set piece occurs, that's the last action set piece. And we're not trying to throw yet another thing on top of another thing on top of another thing. He sort of knew,
right.
He knew when to quit. He gave you everything that you could have asked for, and then didn't overstay the welcome. And to me, you don't necessarily hear the word discipline in the same sentence as $150 million summer blockbuster. Which, by the way, I can't believe that the movie cost quote unquote just $150 million. It looks like it cost $1 billion.
The production value is absolutely insane.
The cinematography,
and you're right.
Yeah, just the cinematography is out. It's outstanding. It's beyond it's beyond compare. Really, I just. I'm just going on and on about the technical thing, because that was what just blew me away. And I have a feeling that when I get a chance to see the movie again, I'll sort of get involved in the story, of which there's plenty. And that's the great thing about this, is that for all of the wonderful visual delights that George Miller provides with this film, there is no skimping on story. The dialogue is, for the most part, solid. There was a couple of cheesy lines or just line delivery, I thought. I kind of, chuckled a couple times here and there, but whatever. It's just like minor nitpicking. everything felt to me like George Miller just exercised all of his demons, all the stuff he'd been saving up for 30 years, and just threw it out onto the screen. I'll tell you what, the rock guy, the guy playing the guitar and the band,
yeah,
that sealed it for me. I absolutely flipped out with the rock guy and the band.
It's insane. There is in this film's this film is one chase, and it's the bad people chasing Tom Hardy, Charlize Theron, and the five women who are in this semi hauler, this tanker that's they're carrying water, mother's milk, and fuel.
Yeah,
which are the hot items in this post apocalyptic world. And there's this posse of these insanely imaginative vehicles that are chasing him. And one of them is a vehicle that's sole purpose is to have these guys beat these gigantic drums. And on the front of the vehicle is this guy on bungee cords playing, what do you call it? The guitar that has two sets of frets? You know what I'm talking about?
I know.
The double-headed guitar.
Yeah, the double-headed guitar that also happens to be a flamethrower.
Right. It's insane. You know what else I love about this is it has such a mass appeal. It's so outrageous and so big and so well made that everybody's going to like it that goes to see it. It's an experience. And I can't remember.
I hope so.
No, I mean, seriously, I can't remember. When have you ever seen a film like this?
And
you
listen.
You can't even compare it to the original trilogy. I mean, Road Warrior is the only great Mad Max film in the original trilogy. The first one's good. Road Warrior is astounding. And then Thunderdome is just what it is.
Yeah, it's they are three very... I kind of compare the original trilogy to the original trilogy of Evil Dead in that.
That's a good comparison.
You know, in that the first movie is this low budget exploitation movie that gets noticed. The second movie is this higher polished pseudo remake of the first movie with a couple of different beats. You know what I mean? And then, you know, I would say the second road, the Road Warrior is more of a different film than the first, than Evil Dead 2. Evil Dead 2 is very much a remake of Evil Dead 1 in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it's a straight up campy remake.
Exactly.
Right.
And then the third films in the series, you know, Army of Darkness just goes, which I love. I love Army of Darkness. I'll just say that right now.
I own it on Blu-ray.
It goes completely over the top and it's wild and it's crazy. And Thunderdome, which I've seen admittedly only once and it was a while ago. I remember it being very campy and nothing at all like, you know, the second one or the first one, much in the same way that Army of Darkness wasn't really like the first or second Evil Deads.
Right.
There is no equal for Fury Road. You know, the only other film that I can honestly think of that sits alongside of Fury Road is The Raid 2. And I'm only saying that because of the sheer intensity of both movies. They don't share any thematic or, you know, aesthetic similarities. They're very different movies in approach and style and, you know, intent. But both of them are just so unrelentingly assaultive and immersive on the audience that for me, and that just the fact that they happened to come out within the last 2 years, you know, whatever. I think that those are two of the best pieces of action cinema that I've ever seen. I cannot get my head around Fury Road. I there's so much to admire. And the idea that that George Miller at 70 is busting this out on people, it's just insane. And it's just... The idea that he has Babe, Pig in the City, and Fury Road on his resume, it just makes me smile, and I just know that the guy's a genius, because...
And Happy Feet, right?
And Happy Feet, he did both Happy Feets. The second Happy Feet I didn't think was anywhere near as good as the first one. I genuinely enjoyed the first one. I thought it was a lot of fun, and, you know, he brings a sense of, like, madcap to the proceedings in Fury Road, which was all over Babe, Pig in the City, Which I don't know if you've seen the Babe movies. I forget. I know we maybe talked
about them. I have not.
They're so good. And Babe 2 couldn't be any more different than the first one. And he was wise enough to know not to try to repeat what was so magical about the first Babe. And in Babe 2, he just explodes on the universe and goes wild with the visuals, much in the same way that he exploded on his Mad Max universe with Fury Road, and just goes insane with the visuals and just with the all-out approach to, you know, it's maximalist filmmaking, just flipping out and letting it rip. And, you know, it's the end-all be-all of summer action movies, and it transcends, you know, that notion. If this, and again, I hate to always bring up the Oscars again as any sort of like barometer of a film's greatness, but that's because of the culture that we live in. Everybody looks to the Oscars. If this movie is not nominated for Best Picture, then there is a problem, because there will be nothing else like this movie ever again. And the idea that you're going to go out into the middle of the Australian outback in the middle of nowhere for like close to 2 years and put on this sort of a production, it demands attention. I only hope that people go see it in America. I have no doubt this movie will be huge overseas, but there's something that is sort of, I don't know. As much as it is a feminist movie, which I would definitely agree with, I'm not 100% sure how much women are beating down the door to go see this film opening weekend or within like the first, you know, couple of weeks. Do you agree or? Do you not agree?
Well, I think they have no idea. I read some stuff about Charlize Theron's character, but I didn't want to read too much about the film because I wanted to go into it essentially blind and just with what I saw from the trailers and the posters that were released. But I think that the message of the film is well hidden.
Yes.
By the theatrics of the film. And I think once word gets out about what the film is actually about, it'll turn some people off, and it will make some people want to go see it because they're like, "Oh, this is a movie about feminism or whatever. I didn't know that. Let's go check it out." I don't know.
Like I am totally not surprised after having. I was very surprised to see such unanimous critical support. I never expected it to be 187-2. Having seen the film, I now understand why anybody worth their salt writing for film or discussing about the importance of film would have no reason not to give this movie a good review. The two people that didn't should be fired from their jobs. I don't know who they are, but find them and fire them. But having said that, I happen to feel that this will be a divisive movie for people coming out of the theater. I think that people who are going into it with a high set of expectations, I think that those expectations will be met and then some. And I think that some of the people who are on the fence, who go into it, hopefully with an open mind, will have that mind blown. But then, like you said, I have a feeling that there's going to be like some sort of, you know, I don't know, just submental reaction from some of the, you know, the mongrels out there who are going to go see this movie, who aren't going to react well to the idea of, you know, quote unquote, the chick saving the day, you know, when they've been conditioned to think that Tom Hardy's going to be, you know, the end all be all, you know, savior. And again, won't want to spoil anything. And Tom Hardy definitely gets to kick some butt. But as you said, this movie is dominated by women, and it's dominated by the notion of women banding together to fight against something that is, you know, corrupting a group of them. So I from the trailers, because the trailers are just so visually immersive and you're just so excited to see it because of the craziness. They don't hint at the subtext of this film, which is kind of like really dark and really twisted and kind of kinky and weird and like strange. And The mother's milk thing, dude. I mean, like, what was that? Like, the whole thing with those women, like, on the side, and then the guy who's the taste tester. I was like, what the hell? It's just like.
And the little midget with the telescope.
The little midget with the, and you know what I had to, you know what I felt? The little midget with the telescope was very, very Jean-Pierre Jeunet and Terry Gilliam. It's like you said.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was like really out of their world too, I thought, so.
And the guy with the feet and the thing over his nose. It's an insane ride, and I hope everybody goes to see it. The way I gauge, one of the ways I gauge if I really like a film or I don't, is once the film's over, I think to myself, I can't wait to buy this on Blu-ray. I can't wait to see the exclusive Blu-rays or content that's going to come out for it with cover art or a steelbook or a digibook or whatever.
There, but yeah.
Within the first 5 minutes, maybe not even if that, I knew that I needed to own this movie on Blu-ray.
Mm.
I knew it instantly. And I want to take a moment and talk about how fantastical Tom Hardy is as an actor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we can do that.
And speaking for myself, it's funny. The first thing I saw him in was Inception, and I didn't really like him in Inception. I grew tired of the man flirting between Tom Hardy and Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and I was like, who is this guy? Just like, whatever. He's kind of this weird comic relief, and I didn't see him in anything after that. And then when I read he got cast in The Dark Knight Rises, I was like, of course he gets cast in Dark Knight Rises. And then I find out he's going to play Bane, and I was like, oh, really? And then I can't remember if that was the next thing I saw him in, or if I saw him in Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. I think that came out before Dark Knight Rises, and I saw him in that, and I thought to myself, this guy can act. And I loved his story arc in that film. That guy, he gets fucked hard in that film, like brutally bad. Not literally, but
yes.
figuratively. But, you know, and then The Dark Knight Rises came out, and I saw him, and I knew from the trailers, and I knew from the backstory of what Bane is in the comics and what Nolan was going to use, that Tom Hardy was going to be absolutely perfect. I saw that. And then I saw his other stuff like Bronson.
So you had not seen CS.
And Locke.
Yep. Okay.
I saw all that after The Dark Knight Rises because I was obsessed with Tom Hardy.
Gotcha.
And now when I watch Inception, I have an appreciation for Tom Hardy. But the fact that this guy can play Bane and Mad Max and then can also play Ricky Tarr in Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy and Ivan Locke in the film Locke. Have you seen Locke?
Oh yeah, Locke was in my top 15 from last year. He's absolutely
the one man show in his car.
Yeah, it's absolutely incredible, the performance and you know, I love Locke. I love the execution. I love the idea of it. The notion that you would make a movie where it's inside of the car for the whole time and it's a series of phone call conversations.
The audacity of that film, of him being in his car just talking to people over his Bluetooth in his car is incredible to me. Tom Hardy is this insanely great actor. And I can't even wait to see where his career takes him from here. Legend, where he plays the Kray twins, looks unbelievable.
Yeah, it's going to be a blast. Definitely. I've been on the Tom Hardy train since I saw Bronson. That was the first exposure I had to him. I watched Bronson not long after it hit disc. And I mean, everything. Warrior, the mixed martial arts film, he's fantastic.
Yeah, Warrior.
He gives like a Brando-esque performance in that movie. It's like ridiculous. Everything that he's been in, The Drop with James Gandolfini, he's terrific there. I love that movie. Such an underrated crime film. Did you see The Drop?
I did not, and I haven't seen Lawless either.
Oh,
even though
yeah,
I
but that was that was the next one, The Drop and Lawless, buddy. You're going to have a great time with both of those. He's terrific in both. He's never bad. He doesn't give a shit. He changes the way that he looks in everything. He sounds different in everything. He is one of the least vain actors that I've ever seen. He has that metal mask on his face in Fury Road for the first 45 minutes. He wore the Bane mask for the entire time. In a day and age of movie stars continually wanting to look their best and look beautiful, here's a guy who could give a shit. And then when he's cleaned up, he's a great looking guy. He can be smooth. He can be, you know, he can be sleazy.
He's never the same.
He's never the same. I absolutely love him.
Which is perfect. How easy would it be for an actor to rely on the same prowess and demeanor in a way of Bane when you go to play somebody like Mad Max?
Oh, exactly.
Or better yet, do an impression of Mel Gibson.
Oh, completely. He knew well enough to leave the Gibson thing alone. He must have 50 spoken words of dialogue in Fury Road. The entire performance is done through his eyes, through his grunting, and through his body language. I mean, and then through his physical actions.
He's a fantastic physical actor.
And to say nothing of Charlize Theron throwing herself into the intense physicality of the role and of the movie and going toe-to-toe with everybody. How the hell did they make the mechanical arm look like that? I just don't get it. Like, it's flawless. It was unbelievable. She is also another actress. She could care less. She's stunningly beautiful when she gets dressed up. Then she shaves her head, puts grease all over her face, has a mechanical arm, and she's throwing herself around in the desert. I love her. I think she's terrific. We were talking earlier offline about Young Adult. I think that's one of her best performances. And, you know, as an actual fully fleshed out character, I love that movie. Think about her in Monster. Think about her in The Devil's Advocate. Think about her in North Country. Think about her in any number of movies where, you know, she's another person who will change her look, doesn't care, will throw herself into the middle of any role. And I'm just, you know, the two of them was spot on casting. And the other, was that Nicholas Holt?
Holt,
He was awesome. He was such a panic, the whole thing with I live again, the whole thing.
Right.
That was great.
Right.
I thought he was wild. And what were they spray painting in their mouth?
It looked like silver spray paint.
So they were just
like they were huffing.
Huffing. Okay. So that's what I thought.
Without a bag.
Yeah, without a bag. So they were huffing in their last moments before they kamikaze themselves.
Looked like they all blew RoboCop.
Yeah. Yeah. I just a totally, totally, totally bonkers movie. And honestly, if people don't go see this movie, then shame on them. I really hope it's a huge hit.
If Pitch Perfect 2 wins the box office race against Mad Max, I'm not. It's just going to be a sad day for cinema. I was reading earlier before we started recording that it was neck and neck, although there's still the weekend to be had for the rest of it. Not to take anything away from Pitch Perfect 2. I saw the first one. It was fine. I enjoyed it.
Me too. I enjoyed it too for what it was.
I'll probably watch the second one if it comes on HBO or something like that. But.
And I have
is a movie that completely celebrates cinema and everything you can do with a film Mad Max does.
And I totally agree. I think in terms of the opening weekend, I don't think that you can. I think that Pitch Perfect will definitely beat it for the weekend just because of the PG-13 rating and because of the built-in audience for girls and for teens. And, you know, I just think that I think it's an easier sell to people than a hard, you know. And what I also have to say about the R rating of Mad Max, it was never gratuitous at any point.
No.
With the violence. And
never.
The R rating is more, in my opinion, it more has to do with the overall level of intensity than it does.
Right.
Than it does the actual blood level. There's no nudity. There's next to no cursing as much as I can remember. There's no F-bombs or anything. Was there?
I don't think so.
And for a film that has so much violent, you know, spectacle, Miller really knew that sometimes the best things are left to your imagination. Even in the most gory, quote unquote, of moments, he does leave a fair amount up to your brain. But yeah, I was like kind of like not disappointed in the lack of gore, but I was surprised, given that it was an R-rated film, that the rating was more born out of the
adult content.
Just the themes, the subtext, and the overall intensity of the whole thing. I don't know if I've ever seen a movie that has been that breakneck intense for 2 hours. I mean, there's been some. There's been a lot of movies that have a crazy grinding pace like that. But I don't know if there's been a movie that has like just been that overwhelming, that huge to take in. So.
Yeah, I agree with you. I thought I was going to be going into something like a Django Unchained or an Inglourious Basterds, where the level of violence is so over the top.
Yes.
And outrageous. I thought there was going to be blood squirting everywhere. Did you see it in 3D?
I did not. I did not want to see it. And in fact, it was interesting. They have it playing, out the wazoo in 3D. They have it playing on three screens. They have it on the hour. And I went to the theater. I went to see it with my dad, and who we've both seen movies in 3D together. We're not adverse to doing so if it really warrants it. But we both really wanted to just take in the visuals, just without anything over our eyes, and just see the movie in 2D first. I'm definitely gonna see it in 3D so I can see the comparison. Did you see it?
I saw it in 3D, and I really enjoyed it. The 3D was comparable to the 3D in Prometheus, which I think has some of the best 3D I've seen on film.
Interesting. I didn't get a chance to see that in 3D.
There's not shit popping out at you, and it's not used as a gimmick. It's just used as that extra dimension. You didn't see Prometheus in 3D. I'm trying to think of another example. Hugo is a good example of that. You saw that in 3D.
I did.
Yeah.
Great. Yeah.
Right. It just kind of adds that layer. It's interesting how I think that's the best use of 3D that I've seen, as opposed to I did see like something like Drive Angry in 3D, which I loved, and I love the film. I loved it in 3D, but that was obviously used as a gimmick. Because have you seen Drive Angry 3D?
No, I did not.
Oh, dude, there's this odd, not to get too far off track, but if you ever get a 3D TV, you need to buy the 3D Blu-ray, because there's this outrageous sex scene with Nicolas Cage where he's having sex with this chick and all these guys are busting in, and it's a shootout sex scene in 3D. It's one of the greatest things I've ever seen in my entire life.
Well, the shootout sex scene in Shoot 'Em Up is an all-timer for me. So if this...
Right, but that wasn't
that
in 3D.
That wasn't in 3D. But I love that that he's having sex with a lactating hooker, and then all of these guys come in and start shooting up, and he continues to have sex with her while he's shooting up the whole room. So I never saw Drive Angry. I it looked to me like complete crap, and I figured it was just another
It's supposed to be.
It's supposed to be. Okay.
It's one of those films where it's Nicolas Cage being...
like a lunatic.
Essentially poking fun at himself with being, oh yeah, you guys think I'm bad. Well, I'm going to show you bad. That's what it is.
I never saw that one. All right. Well, when I get the 3D TV down the road, I'll have to check it out. So,
without a doubt.
Well, if you don't have anything more to add for the moment on Fury Road, you want to segue into, a very different kind of movie and very long engagement.
Absolutely. I just hope everybody goes to see Mad
yes,
Max. I love
definitely
it.
Go see it. Support filmmaking when it's of that caliber. So a very long engagement. I picked this movie for our featured film for the week. Just a little bit of background. Film came out in 2004, came out at the end of the year in December, should have been more present at the Oscars, because it is a quote unquote Oscar film. It is directed by Jean-Pierre Jeunet, the French filmmaker who has either directed or co-directed City of Lost Children, Delicatessen, Amelie, just to name a couple. And this is a just an overwhelmingly sad, beautiful, violent, both from the war scenes and both on an emotional front, story, World War One story about a woman played by Audrey Tautou from Amelie, where she is separated from her fiancé, who's drafted into service, and essentially has to put the pieces together in sort of puzzle piece fashion about the whereabouts of her fiancé and did he make it out of the war alive. And the film touches on trench warfare and about how the soldiers, a variety of soldiers, would typically shoot themselves, you know, in the hand or foot, maim themselves in order to get out of serving their tours, either just because they were just emotionally spent, psychologically damaged, just couldn't do it anymore. So the film focuses on, I think it's five soldiers, one of which is Audrey Tautou's fiancé, who have been court-martialed and who are, you know, going to be brought, you know, to trial or, you know, left to die basically on the battlefield. And through flashbacks, through stories, through investigations, she comes to terms with the truth of his whereabouts. Without spoiling anything, the film has an incredibly poignant ending, one that is equal parts hopeful and equal parts sad. And this, to me, is sort of, I've been a fan of all of Jean-Pierre Jeunet's films. And this, to me, is sort of just the apex of his style and his intent as a filmmaker. He brings a sense of whimsy to everything. And certainly in this film, he does on any number of occasions get into sort of the romanticized version of the past and of history. And, you know, when combined with the just the terror of warfare that this movie certainly shows you, I think that he just made an incredible film. And it's a movie that just not enough people saw. This is a film that, you know, made $70 million worldwide in the theater, and $6 million of that came from American ticket buyers. And to me, I'll never understand the notion of buying a film for release and then doing nothing with it and not supporting it or just not, you know, getting behind it when it's clearly been made with care and with passion, the way that something like this was. And it's just a film, I think, just again, it's just yet another movie. Every year, there's so many great movies that come out and they fly under the radar. This one was rightfully nominated for cinematography. It's some of the best cinematography I've ever seen in any movie. And production design. The production design in the movie is exquisite. But it deserved more than that. It deserved just more of a presence with people. Critically, it was well received. But I still sort of feel like it wasn't well enough received. And again, I don't remember exactly how many films of Jean-Pierre Jeunet you've seen, but to me, this feels just like the real sum of his parts as a filmmaker. What was your first impression of the movie, not having seen it in the theater and getting a chance to see it for the first time this week?
I had not seen this film. I had not heard of this film. The only films of his I had seen was obviously Amelie, which I loved. I loved that film. I'd seen Delicatessen, Micmac.
Yep. Yeah, Micmac.
I saw that one. That was on Netflix. And then, of course, I've seen Alien 4, which Alien Resurrection, yep. Which I love the fact that that's the only Hollywood movie he's made. And
it'll likely be the only Hollywood movie he made.
Right, and to that movie's defense, it's not
no,
bad.
Not at all.
It's good in a way. It's better than Alien 3. But anyway, I had never seen this, and again, I told you this before, but I just wanted to thank you for making me watch this film and choosing this film as our film of the week. This film. is one of the best films I have ever seen that deals with the horrors of war. And it is also one of the greatest love stories I have ever seen on film. And I'm not ashamed to admit this, but this movie, and I told you this right after I watched it, right after, as soon as it was over, I remember telling you that I was emotionally wrecked with the conclusion of this film. And I don't want people to take that the wrong way. But I was crying as the film came to a head, and everything falls into place. And man, it, I almost, you know what? How's this for honesty? I almost cried like three times prior to the ending. The flashback of the two characters meeting as children, where she has polio and he's making fun of her for walking funny. Then he's asking her, does it hurt? Mm-hmm. And then he's like, well, you can come up to my light tower that my dad's the keeper of, and I'll carry you up there. And you watch their budding romance, and it carries on into pre-World War One, where they're BFF and they're hanging out every day and they're like the best friends in the world, and they're playing the game of pickup sticks and they're distracting each other, and they start to like kiss each other, and then you see it happen right in front of you, where it's like, whoa, we love each other in not a friend kind of way. I mean, that was one moment. The Jodie Foster scene,
she comes in for
film.
She comes in for 10 minutes and just kills it. It's like,
She fucking William Hurts it from A History of Violence. She comes in she probably has 10 minutes of screen time, and her storyline is drawn out probably 15, 20 minutes of her storyline. But Jesus, man.
Yeah, and you have to want to do that role. Like, this was a French production, right?
It's a French film. It's a straight up
French
movie. Film.
She speaks French in it. She's not the star. It's a thank,
no.
It's, in a way, it's like this thankless role in a sense, but then it's not. She brings so much to it in such a short amount of screen time, and that whole plot line that is.
It's 3 years off of her winning two Best Actress Oscars. So what that tells me is that she wants to be in this movie. She needs to be in this movie, because Jodie Foster does not make a lot of films. And she is very selective with what she makes and what she attaches her name to. And this film and her in it, and it's just it's one of the best films I've ever seen. Honestly, I still can't stop thinking about it. I love Amelie, man. I own Amelie. I've watched it a bunch, and I thought Amelie is such this sweet love story, and oh my gosh, it's so cute, and she's so cute, and it's poignant. And then I watch A Very Long Engagement, and it's everything Amelie is, but it is taken up like 16 notches.
Yes, it is. I agree.
And while the film's going on, I'm laughing because the uncle and the aunt are awesome.
Yeah, they bring a really like really sweet, not forced kind of, like, you know, like sometimes with humor, when you inject humor into these dramas, it can feel forced or it can feel unnatural. And her whole thing about, you know, doggy farts is just so funny. Like, you know, you just
it's more than just humor. It's heartfelt. And when I laughed out loud at the part where the main character is reflecting on her growing up with polio, and she's laying naked in her bed, and her aunt is rubbing the mustard on her spine, and the uncle's sitting on the other side of the bed, and he sticks his finger in and puts it in his mouth. It's just, I love that. This movie is so sweet, and it's so heartfelt, and it's so, I want to say it's emotionally traumatizing, but I don't want people to take that the wrong way.
I know what I mean? I absolutely know what you mean. Yeah, this, without spoiling the film, This movie shows, like you said, it shows the horrors of war in a very Private Ryan, Paths of Glory type way.
It's Paths of Glory, man. It's Paths of Glory meets Amelie.
With the modern, you know, just with the modern violence of Private Ryan, like, you get to see some really nasty stuff in this movie. I mean, between the guy being blown to bits all over, all over Manik, and then the, you know, just the headshots and the, you know, the bodies falling left and right. He did not spare any, he didn't spare anything in this movie. He showed you what it would have been like to have been in no man's land, you know, in between the two fronts.
Right.
And like you said, you don't want to put people off by saying that it is a harrowing movie, but it is. But because he's such a confident filmmaker in his ability to juggle tone, you go from scenes that are sweet and funny and beautiful to downright horrifying. I mean, the set piece, if you want to call it that, inside of the triage center with the hydrogen blimp.
The hydrogen blimp?
I mean,
blimp?
Are you kidding me with that sequence? Like
Only he would make a film like this and have a hydrogen balloon hovering in the top of this greenhouse-ish building that is a triage. And you know before you even see the building or see the scene physically what happens, because it's told to you. So the entire time you're watching it, you're just like, oh my gosh. Oh my God! You're waiting for the mortar to come through the glass in the ceiling. It's just, and aside from this being a fine film when it comes to performances and how emotional it is and how touching and heartfelt it is, his aesthetic is absolutely insane.
Yes.
It's on the same tier of insanity as George Miller is with Mad Max. It is just fucking beautiful.
Yeah, every shot, every shot is composed to within an inch of its life, but it never feels artificial. The color scheme, the camera movement, and more importantly, how he uses color and camera movement to enforce an idea or a feeling.
Let me interject real quick. And then you go back to it. But his aesthetic and visual style is on the same tier as Malick and Kubrick.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Without a doubt. Yeah. I mean, with everything you were just saying, I couldn't shake this film after I saw it. I thought about it. I've still thought about it today. This is a film that's going to hold on to you, and you're going to carry a piece of it. If you love film as much as Nick and I do, and a lot of people who listen to this that we interact with and talk with, I mean, you're going to watch this film, and it's going to stay inside of you. And there's going to be a piece of this film inside of you. That's how good it is.
I
still can't even believe how good this
film
is.
I agree. Listen, because I was a Jean-Pierre Jeunet fan when this movie opened, I was living in Los Angeles at the time, and I drove out to Burbank in the only theater that it was playing in, as I recall, because that was really the only reason why I would have driven out to Burbank. And I went to see it with six other people in the theater. And this is L.A., where, you know, almost every movie sells out. And I'm in the theater with, 10 people at, 10 o'clock at night. And I sit there and I'm just utterly riveted, and I'm crying inside because the place isn't sold out and it's not filled up. And, you know, I've never met someone who I have recommended this movie to who has come to me and said that wasn't good or I wasn't blown away by it. I mean, this is my dad's top 10, and I use my dad as a great, barometer of, taste for movies. He doesn't flip out as readily as easily as I do on some things. He's a little bit more of a tough critic, I think, than I am sometimes, which is good. But this movie I know affected him, My wife has seen it a couple of times, and she's not one to rewatch movies, and she would see it again. It's just, if, like you said, if you care about cinema and you haven't seen it, you owe it to yourself to check it out, because it is truly one that got away and deserves a higher profile. There isn't even an American Blu-ray available. If you want this movie on Blu-ray, you have to have a region-free player, which thankfully I've invested in, and the Blu-ray looked just gorgeous. So.
And I'm glad you brought that up, because if people want to see this film and they live in the Region 1 area, North America, I rented the film on Amazon Prime. I think it was $3.99 for the HD version for 24 hours. You can buy the film for, I think, $6 in standard definition or $10 for the high definition. If I end up not getting a Region 2 or a Region Free player, I'm definitely going to purchase the HD copy. And I will say that the streaming quality of this film was absolutely beautiful. I'm sure I know for a fact the Blu-ray looks better, but since I haven't broke on through to the side of Region Free, Region 2 like you have, it's a good option for people who stream and stuff like that. Here, just let me to touch back on how good this movie is, and how I cried at the end of the film.
Oh yeah, I'm right there with you.
But I was crying, and how I almost cried a couple of other times throughout the film. I'm not one to cry in movies. The last movies that I saw that I cried in was the ending of 12 Years a Slave. Because it was so touching, and the Tree of Life and To the Wonder, not because I was sad or overjoyed, just because they were an emotional experience that I was so overwhelmed by the beauty of it. It's one of those examples of like how you're so touched by art that you cry. And I always thought that was ridiculous until I saw the Tree of Life and To the Wonder. And probably before that, I almost cried at the end of Curious Case of Benjamin Button when the ending happens and he's the baby. And it's just like, wow. Wow. Nice one, Fincher. But, Well, seriously, I don't want to spoil.
Yeah, no, the last shot of that.
All right.
Movie,
well, whatever. If you haven't seen Benjamin Button, whatever. He starts out born as an old man and ages backwards. So by the time he's, I don't know, at the end of the film when he's 60 or 70, he's a newborn baby and dies.
Yeah, it's a great movie. Listen, if I was gonna talk about all the movies that I cried at, we'd be here for 7.5 hours. I'm a massive cinematic sucker for the cry. I will cry over, you know, a long distance telephone commercial if done right. I mean, that's just the way that I am. So, with this movie, the ending never ceases to make me tear up. I get emotional over any number of bits in this film. In my opinion, if you have a heart, then it'll be next to impossible not to be choked up over what this movie is implying about love and about, the ability for people to, hold out hope for, you know, someone that they love to get out of something miserable. But yeah, no, I mean, listen, I cried at the end of Fury Road. So just because it was over. So, but I'm really glad that it made an impact on you the way that it did. I'm always curious again, whenever I recommend any movie to anybody, what they'll say, because, you know, I want them to feel like their time has been, you know, well spent. So I'm very happy that it hit all the right notes for you.
I know. And we're 2-1 now with, you picking two films that I had not seen prior, and I only picked Star 80 that you hadn't seen, so I need to up my game here.
We're doing good so far.
Although we're doing right. Man, I just can't thank you enough for putting this on my radar, like I said, with King of the Hill. Actually, three then, right? With King of the Hill? I don't know.
Yeah, with King of the Hill, so.
But King of the Hill and this film, it's just, thanks again for that, because I'm sure I would have seen them somewhere down the road, but I'm glad that I saw them now. And I can't even wait to watch A Very Long Engagement again. I told people at work about it, and I work with people that just wouldn't be able to handle A Very Long Engagement.
Well, I'm glad, man. I mean, that's sort of my whole hope with this podcast series is that, you know, we get a chance to spotlight things that we know people are going to definitely see in the theater or are going to rent, you know, obviously because they're of huge importance. But I'm really hoping that we can really shine a spotlight on movies that got overlooked, that didn't get the time of day paid to them when they were first came out, and, you know, throughout the years have endured, you know, over, you know, countless other releases that come and go. So yeah, absolutely excited. You want to kick off our top five with Colin Farrell?
Yeah, I'd love to. We're doing the top five of Colin Farrell, who is one of Nick and I's favorite actors. We both love him. I love him and everything. I'm super excited for True Detective Season 2, since they just released an actual, somewhat of an actual trailer where there's actual dialogue in it. I'm super excited for Colin Farrell in that, as for the rest of the kid. Even Taylor Kitsch, who I just never cared about before. I think he looks fabulous in it, too. Yeah, so we're doing Colin Farrell, Jodie Foster, two actors that Nick and I both love. I can't even wait to discuss these roles further with you. I'll start with Colin Farrell. My number five is Horrible Bosses, which, looking at Farrell's filmography, it's rather impressive. I know there's films that you love him in that I have not seen that I need to see, that we spoke about. What I really love is when an actor breaks their typecast, whether it's a dramatic actor that does a comedy or a comedic actor that does a serious dramatic performance. And that's very hard to do because actors do that all the time and it doesn't work a lot of times. But Colin Farrell in Horrible Bosses as Jason Sudeikis's new boss, who's this piece of shit, coked out daddy's boy that now gets the company because his dad died. He's outrageous in it with his little shitty pot belly and his comb over, and he's all coked up and he wants to fire all the fat people because they scare him. It's just outrageous. I liked the film. I liked all the actors that played the horrible bosses. Kevin Spacey was great, but he was just being Kevin Spacey. Jennifer Aniston was fine. To me, the standout of the entire film is Colin Farrell. I just, oh my God, he's whenever I want to rewatch it, it's solely based on Colin Farrell's performance. That's my rewatchability for that film. He's insane, and he's so much fun. And you can tell he's having fun playing the character. I love it. All right, so my number five is Horrible Bosses. My number four is Crazy Heart. I loved the film. It's interesting. I saw it a long time ago with some of my buddies. We saw a double feature. We saw Crazy Heart and A Single Man. And Crazy Heart was the film we all wanted to see. And then A Single Man was kind of like, oh, it's playing afterwards, so let's just go see that.
That movie blew me.
Crazy Heart, A Single Man. A Single Man's one of the best films that came out
I hope Tom Ford
in the last
makes
decade.
That movie
bar none. He is. It's going to be a two-part thriller, and I think Jake Gyllenhaal is going to be in it. It just got announced a week or two ago. Yeah. And like each film's going to be a different perspective, I think. I don't know.
Oh, wow.
I'm not sure. I have to look into it.
He's
but,
taking a while.
Tom
project,
Ford.
So that's cool. Continue. Go ahead.
Well, old boy's designing for Gucci. He's got to run
that's
Gucci,
true.
Too. Anyway, yeah. We'll talk about A Single Man. That's one of my favorite films of all time. It's absolutely mind-blowing. Anyway, so Crazy Heart. I was all excited for it. I love Jeff Bridges. He's one of my all-time favorite actors. I was very excited to see the film. I had read the book prior. I was disappointed by the film and its ending because the ending to the book is much different, and it's a deleted scene on the DVD Blu-ray. when I've probably rewatched it at least 10 times since I saw it. I love it now. I like it. I like it a lot. The interesting thing to me in the film is obviously Jeff Bridges is amazing in it, and he finally gets his Oscar after 40 years of acting. Finally, he gets his Oscar, which was great. But Colin Farrell's my favorite part of that movie, and I love the fact that all you hear about him before he shows up, and I think he probably shows up at the 40-minute mark, around there, 45-minute mark, is all you hear about Colin Farrell is he's not Jeff Bridges doesn't like him. And Jeff Bridges resents the fact that he was in his band, and now Jeff Bridges' star has faded. And Tommy Sweet, who is Colin Farrell, is the star. He's the rising star in country music, and everybody wants to see Tommy Sweet, and Tommy Sweet wants Bad Blake, who's played by Jeff Bridges, to open for him in a concert, and of course Jeff Bridges doesn't open for anybody. And you know, you have that all dynamic, and then once he enters the film, he's this very gracious and humble person. And you know from right away when you see him and how he interacts with Jeff Bridges that he owes everything to Jeff Bridges, and he acknowledges that, and he wants to help Jeff Bridges. And I love I don't like country music. I like older country music like Highwaymen, Johnny Cash, Kris Kristofferson, Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, that kind of stuff, which is why I like Crazy Heart,
because yeah, I'm right there with you.
Country music that it has. But I loved the fact that Colin Farrell also sang, and it was actually him singing, and it felt very natural, and it sounded very good. I knew Jeff Bridges sang. I have his album, and I have his original album that he released prior to Crazy Heart, but I didn't know that Colin Farrell sang, and he gives an incredibly humbled and gracious performance in the film. And I love the fact that he's in it, because if you're going to make this film about Jeff Bridges where he's this alcoholic country singer, why would you cast Colin Farrell as his former protege that now overtook his mantle? How random is that?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
You know? Right. I'll stop gushing about Colin Farrell and Crazy Heart. My number three, I just watched it today for the first time, is Michael Mann's film Miami Vice, which is essentially an interpretation or a remake or whatever of the show Miami Vice that he was the showrunner for. Dude, I love the film. I loved Colin Farrell as Sonny Crockett. I love the TV show. Love Don Johnson.
And the film is most definitely not the TV show.
No, not at all, but it is. But it is, though. That's what's so great about the film. The film, no, man, the film, if the TV show Miami Vice was made in the 2000s, that's what the movie is. It's an update of the TV show. And it's great. And I was skeptical of it, even though I love Colin Farrell, because This is the best way I can describe it. 20 years from now, if a Mad Men movie gets made and somebody's going to play Don Draper, you're automatically going to dismiss it, because no one's ever going to play Don Draper, because John Hamm's Don Draper. Sonny Crockett is just an iconic of a character. Don Johnson, I mean, that's who Don Johnson is Sonny Crockett. Colin Farrell's amazing in it. We spoke about it. Just the ultimate alpha male. He's got the sleazy mustache, the slick back hair, and what'd you call it? His 6 o'clock shadow in the film. It's beautiful, man. He doesn't speak with contractions because he doesn't have to. That's why he's so awesome. So that's my number three, and I'm sure he's high on your list. So we'll be able to talk more about it. We'll be able to talk more about it when you do your five. My number two is In Bruges. I was completely blown away by that film. I knew it was a comedy. I looked forward to seeing it. I had no idea how dark and heavy of a film that was, and what Colin Farrell was struggling with the entire time throughout the film. I had no idea about that. I just remember him winning the Golden Globe for Best Actor in a Comedy and how blown away he was by winning that award because he wasn't expecting it. In Bruges is a terrific film, and Colin Farrell is he's out of control in it, in a good and a bad way. He's frantic. He's fantastic in it. And then my number one for Colin Farrell, can you guess what it is?
There's so many options. I could guess.
I'll just tell you. my number one is Phone Booth.
Oh, okay.
I probably didn't know who Colin Farrell really was. First thing I saw him in was Minority Report. I liked him in Minority Report. I can't remember if Daredevil came out before or after that. I liked him in Daredevil, too, even though it's a shitty movie. I still enjoyed it. Phone Booth is amazing to me. I don't know if I own it. I got to rewatch it. But what I love about Phone Booth is it's a one-man show, essentially. I mean, you have Forrest Whitaker and then the voice of Kiefer Sutherland and whatever's going on around the phone booth. But you know an actor is great if he can hold the whole film up on his own and show you a ranging performance like he does in that film. It's comparable to Tom Hardy in Locke or Tom Hanks in Castaway. That's how good his performance is. And it was a very hard top 10 list for me to – or top 5 list for me to make. Any one of these could be number one in a way, sans Horrible Bosses. But Colin Farrell is just a great actor, and I truly love everything he's in. I'm immensely looking forward to True Detective Season 2. And, I should have just put a tie for his number one performance as Phone Booth and True Detective Season 2 because I know he's not going to disappoint. I know he's not going to disappoint. He has the Sonny Crockett sleazy stash and the brass knuckles, mind you. So, I love Colin Farrell. Just give me yours. I can't even wait. I can't even wait to talk more about Colin Farrell with your thoughts.
Yeah, very hard for me to come up with a top five because I've really enjoyed his work. Ever since I saw him, I'm going to go with a tie for five because I'm a glutton for his stuff. I'm going to go with the first movie that I ever saw him in, which was Tigerland. I had an opportunity actually to see that film in the theater, and about a minute before it started, Ollie Larder came in and sat next to me and my buddy, which is still pretty cool. I can remember that. That was pretty fun. But didn't realize who it was until after the movie. It was great. But yeah, just really, really, really intense performance. I'm not sure if you've seen Tigerland.
But
it's very obvious that when you watch Tigerland, now even out of context, that the guy was going to be a star and that he had, just an inherent charisma and, there was something special going on there and, He excels with a sort of live wire, presence in a lot of his roles. Tigerland, he's terrific. It's Joel Schumacher's very gritty, I think it was shot 16 millimeter, as I recall. Very gritty Vietnam training movie. So highly recommend you checking that out. I think you'll be really impressed by his work there. But it's a tie for number five with Tigerland and with Robert Towns' Ask the Dust.
I haven't seen that, and I know I need
to see it. We should probably even just do it as a straight-out featured for our main film for our podcast, because it's yet another movie that just sort of came and went and is way better than the Rotten Tomatoes score. This is a movie about a writer in Los Angeles in the 20s. He's an Italian immigrant trying to, write the great American novel. And he falls in love with a Mexican waitress played by Salma Hayek. And Robert Towne basically does a sort of this romantic, just this absolutely gorgeous drama. Caleb Deschanel shot it. And it's really just a poignant romance between, this intense, fiery lady and this sort of, internal, sort of just this searching of this guy was searching for himself within his writing and within Los Angeles. And I love the film. I think it's really good. And again, it looks wonderful and he's great in it. My number four is going to be his performance in Oliver Stone's Alexander, which for me is one of the best historical epics ever made. Thoroughly underrated. I was actually irate when critics destroyed that movie and nobody saw it in the theater in America. It was a big hit overseas, thankfully. But I think that Alexander is extraordinary. I think that the ambition of that movie is immense, and his performance is huge. He carries that movie from front, back, middle, wherever you want to call it. I loved him in the film. Just an incredible piece of soul-stirring, speechifying performance. And again, I think that Alexander is just woefully undervalued. The battle scenes in that movie are some of the best battle scenes in the historical context that has ever been done for film, especially the one there in the jungle with the war elephants. I still think that's just one of the most ridiculous things I've ever seen.
Let me just interject here real quick. I saw Alexander opening night. I bought the DVD.
Yeah, I own every version of that.
I bought the Blu-ray when it came out. Then I bought the director's cut Blu-ray. And then I bought the Alexander Ultimate Cut. So essentially what I'm saying is I'm on the exact same wavelength and level with you when it comes to Alexander. Let me just say this. Christopher Plummer plays Aristotle in the film. I mean, if that doesn't tell you that the film is just absolutely great, I don't know what else.
Everything.
But yeah, I love Alexander.
The cast in that movie, the visuals, the everything, the subtext of it, the challenging nature of the structure, Vangelis' score, unbelievable. So, number three is In Bruges. One of his most, emotionally intense roles, filled with all sorts of anguish and inner turmoil. Great chemistry with Brendan Gleeson. Loved his work in Bruges. Just a really good crime flick. It's a crime flick with a conscience, with a lot of style, a lot of dark humor. Number two is going to be Terrence Malick's The New World. Absolutely loved his performance there as John Smith, the great, explorer who first falls in love with Pocahontas, and then goes off, traversing the rest of the world. And, I just absolutely love that movie, The New World. It's just a beguiling film. I saw it five times in the theater. It was right around the time of my real intense bromance with Colin Farrell, and I think it's just a magical performance and a magical movie. And my number one, without hesitation, is Miami Vice. That's the end all be all for me, for him as a performer. I thought that he exuded such command and machismo and sexuality and I love his interaction with Gong Li. I love how he walks in that movie. I love how he talks in the movie. I've always said that if I could ever step into the shoes of an actor in any movie for, a couple of hours, it would be, his shoes in that film. I loved it. The alternating between 4, 5, and 6 o'clock shadow that he has going on is legendary. And he fit the Michael Mann bill for, the prototypical introspective, loner, lead that man loves so much. So without question, number one for me is Miami Vice, a film that I also just am enamored with. Another one I saw five times in the theater and I've been obsessed with since it came out. So.
Yeah. I mean, he's definitely the breed between James Caan's Thief and De Niro in Heat.
Yep.
As far as man's alpha males go.
And definitely, so, and I'll second the love for his work in Horrible Bosses. He really was unexpectedly funny there. And, he's been great in everything. Seven Psychopaths, Phone Booth, The Recruit, you know, Ondine, which is a really cool little movie. I'm not sure if you've ever seen that.
The Neil Jordan like film?
The Mermaid movie. I thought that was pretty neat. He's always good.
Right.
You know, I mean, Cassandra's Dream, where he was paired up with Ewan McGregor for Woody Allen. Big fan of that movie.
I just wish I liked that
movie. Oh, I really liked that with Tom Wilkinson. I love that film.
I liked it, but I wished I liked it more. But yeah, I mean, I like it. I wish I loved it, I should say. I just didn't love it. But I liked it a lot. Yeah, you're right. And before we segue into Jodie Foster, I just wanted to plug again. I sent Nick a selfie of myself earlier today. So take over from essentially before Nick takes over. This is probably the best thing anyone's ever said to me in my entire life. Ladies, listen.
A very alluring image of my podcasting partner in a pair of shades that directly recalled the manliness of Colin Farrell in Miami Vice. So females in the Chicago area, take note. You've got a guy on the prowl.
Yeah, and Nick was even giving me directions on how to, like, trim my beard to get the 6 o'clock shadow. It was awesome. Seriously, I can't thank you enough for saying that. That's one of the best things anybody's ever said to me. So, anyway, we'll move on to our Jodie Foster top five, because I look like Colin Farrell and my night has nowhere to go. I mean, my life has nowhere to go but down from this moment, but... Yeah, so Jodie Foster.
I'm glad I made your day.
Jodie Foster. You did, seriously. That was fantastical. Our Jodie Foster's our female actor for the week. She's fantastic. I mean, what can you say about Jodie Foster? Just as a person, she's amazing. As an actress, she's just great. I always look forward to seeing whatever film she's going to be in, because as I said earlier, she's incredibly selective. So, you know, if she's in a film, it's going to be good. All right, so I'll start off. My number five is Panic Room. Love Panic Room. I think that that movie gets unfairly shat upon in a way. I think it's very good, and I think she's fantastic in it. I think it's a very good film, obviously made by David Fincher, who's a fantastic director. I kind of look at Panic Room as I do Tarantino's Death Proof. If that's your worst film, I mean, you're doing pretty good as a director. Although I could say Alien 3, but Fincher totally got screwed over by the studio with Alien 3. But, I mean, I love Panic Room, and if that's David Fincher's worst, quote-unquote, worst film, that's how you know he's an amazing filmmaker, because Panic Room is great. My number four is Taxi Driver. I still, to this day, when I watch the film, I can't even believe that's Jodie Foster as the 12-year-old prostitute who is just controlled by Harvey Keitel and then saved by De Niro. And she's just she's absolutely amazing in that film, and she is incredible to watch. And I love the career that she's had after essentially Taxi Driver being her first thing. She got an Academy Award nomination. She's just fantastic in that film. And I love that film. I love everything about that film. And she just is a, nobody else could have played that part. I mean, that's bottom line with her in Taxi, as Iris in Taxi Driver. My number three is Jodie Foster in A Very Long Engagement. And she is incredible in that film, and I can't stress how incredible that film is enough. But, you know, that film is so great, and then the Jodie Foster small scene is the cameo, or is the cherry on top. I mean, she has an extended cameo, and she's fantastic in it, and it doesn't feel out of place. It's not distracting. Having an American actress in a French film speaking French, she's not, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's perfect. It's amazing.
It's unbelievable to me that was even thought of, to add Jodie Foster into this film. And that's part of the reason what makes it so amazing. My number two is The Accused, which she won her first Oscar for. That's a tough movie to watch. I've only seen it once or twice, and I just feel so bad for her in that film, and it's truly a soul-bearing performance by Foster, and I mean, it's a good film in general, but she is just great in it. And then my number one is Silence of the Lambs as Agent Starling. You know, people love Silence of the Lambs. They love Hannibal Lecter. Hannibal Lecter's become fetishized with a lot of people, the TV show, the books, everything. I love Hannibal Lecter. He's a great character. I love the book series, sans the last one, Hannibal Rising, which is terrible. I never saw the film, even though, coincidentally enough, the guy that's the love interest or the fiancé in A Very Long Engagement plays Hannibal Lecter in that, which kind of makes me want to watch Hannibal Rising now. But I struggle when I talk to people about Silence of the Lambs, because it's always the Anthony Hopkins show, and it's always the Hannibal Lecter show when it comes to Silence of the Lambs. And yes, this is the best thing Anthony Hopkins has ever done, probably ever will do. He plays one of the most iconic characters in film and literature. But people forget that Anthony Hopkins is only in the film for, you know, he has like 15 minutes of screen time throughout the whole film. And the whole film is on Jodie Foster. I mean, you have Buffalo Bill, Ted Levine's great, Scott Glenn's great as Jack Crawford, but the entire film rests on Starling. And she's the main character, and she is just, every time I could watch Silence of the Lambs on an endless loop. That's one of the few films that I feel is a perfect film. Yeah. And she is just breathtakingly amazing in it, and I just can't get enough of her performance in that. So that's my top five. So lay it on me.
My top five, it's going to have some similar titles that you brought up. My number five is I Cheated Again. I did a tie between A Very Long Engagement. Again, only about a 10 or 15 minute performance, but something that is incredibly memorable. I tied that with Panic Room, you know, a Hollywood thriller that she's not necessarily known for, and, you know, leading it very well, and just was a perfect match, I think, for Fincher. I think they did really well together. Number four is The Accused, as you said, a soul-bearing performance, a movie that I've only seen once, but that I can remember vividly. A tough film to watch, but, you know, certainly announcing a, you know, just further talent from her as an actress. My number three is Contact. Flaws and all, I absolutely love that movie. It will always fascinate me to no end. And I thought that her performance was really, really good. She anchors that movie, which is a very big film, very special effects heavy film. And I loved the humanity that she brought to that role. If we were ever going to meet aliens, you know, she would be a good person to have, you know, be the first human to meet an alien, I think. So even if it is her father, spoiler alert. Number two would be The Work in The Silence of the Lambs. It goes without saying, as you said, it is a flawless movie. It's Jonathan Demme just cranking it out of the park completely. Her performance is amazing. It is highly disciplined and beautifully composed. Just one of the best performances that I've seen from a man or woman in anything, any film. And my number one, without a doubt, would be Taxi Driver. I think that when you are of that age and you come to play every day with that material, I just don't think that there are too many people that could have given such the performance that she did. And it's truly a, you know, when you're a child actor, you know, quote unquote, or teen actor or what have you, there's no guarantees that you're going to continue on, that your career is going to lead you down the perfect path. There's so many things that can sway a young actor. You know, the limelight, it's everything, the drugs, the success, the money. She just absolutely kills that movie. I mean, it's ridiculous. She's holding her own with De Niro. She's holding her own with everybody in that movie. And then she continues on to have such an amazing career and doesn't let the success go to her head, if you will. And I just, you know, Taxi Driver is just a mind-blowing movie. I had the opportunity to see that film at a fairly young age on the big screen at a revival screening, and I can remember it vividly. It's a scarring movie on purpose, and her performance is, I think, just absolutely amazing. So that was definitely my number one. And I will say, I'll throw two more out there real quick, just as shout-outs. Liked her a lot in The Brave One. Thought that was a pretty good movie. And
yeah
I liked her a lot.
Good.
I thought she was very good in that. And I really liked her turn in Inside Man.
I was going to
say that. She steals, and I really like that movie a lot. I just wish that I really wish that Spike Lee would just every once in a while make a damn good entertaining movie like that. I've been a fan of his for a long time, but that movie showed that he could sort of play by the studio rules and have some fun still, and still inject it with his personality. But I thought she stole the show. She was terrific as that icy bitch, so I thought she was great.
Right, yeah.
And, yeah, so other than that, I think that, we did our top five, and any notable screenings for you during the week? I know you watched a lot of stuff to prepare for this podcast, so I'm not sure.
Just notably, we're running pretty long here. Notably, Miami Vice, which I will watch again probably this weekend, and A Very Long Engagement, which I will either buy on Amazon Prime or get a Region 2 player and buy the Blu-ray, or hold out for the Region 1 Blu-ray. That's all I really watched, I think. I caught up on Mad Men and Game of Thrones as well, but yeah, I hadn't had a lot of time this week to watch a lot of stuff, so I was able to fit those in, and I was very glad I did.
I'm right there with you on Mad Men. So, I can't wait to see how it finishes up. And over the week, I caught up with Map to the Stars, David Cronenberg's movie with Julianne Moore. I was kind of mixed on the film, but I really like Julianne Moore. I also watched an older film from the late 60s called John and Mary with Dustin Hoffman and Mia Farrow. I thought that was really well done. I liked it a lot. A really cool morning after relationship drama. And I actually had a chance earlier in the week to check out a really cool action film from South Korea called No Tears for the Dead. And it's a further reminder that American shoot 'em up movies are paling in comparison to those of coming from Asia and overseas. It's just a really cool cop film, just a straight ahead sort of thriller with just fantastic beats of action and, you know, crazy gunplay and very John Woo-esque, and lots of fun if you're, you know, into sort of the ultra violent shoot 'em up. So. That's about it for me on the views, and why don't you announce our stuff for next week?
Next week we're going to have an incredibly special podcast that we're both looking forward to immensely. We're going to be discussing Sidney Lumet's 1973 film The Offense with Sean Connery, which was his first post-Bond film, where he was trying to, you know, destruct his image of James Bond playing a English detective that is on the hunt for a serial killer that's raping and murdering schoolgirls. It's a brutal film. It's a dark film. I just got the Blu-ray. I can't wait to rewatch it. It's been a couple of years. It's a hard film to watch, but it's truly great. And what makes this podcast so special is Gary Young, who is the screenwriter of Harry Brown, the Michael Caine film that came out in the late 2000s, is going to be joining us for the podcast, which is remarkable and very exciting for the both of us. We can't even wait to have Gary on. He will give us tremendous insights on The Offense and English films, and I can't even wait to have him on. This is going to be very exciting for
both
of us.
Yeah, I agree. Looking forward to having Gary on, and should be a great great discussion. I have not seen The Offense, so I'm looking forward to it. I'm a big fan of Sidney Lumet in general, and this is one of the, you know, many. He's made so many movies. This is one of many that I have yet to see, so looking forward to it big time.
Yeah, so that's it for this week for episode 6. I still can't believe we've done 6 of these, but I can't even wait. And before Yeah, before we go, I just want to thank all the new likers that we had on our Facebook page, and especially Mark Pellington. And it's just been great, man. It's been a good ride.
Absolutely.
So we'll be here for the long haul. So we will catch everybody on our next podcast.
We'll see you soon.